our original question. Just how much and in what ways do parents really matter? Let's start with the positive correlation. Books in the home equal higher test scores. Most people would look at this correlation and infer an obvious cause and effect relationship. To wit, a little boy named Isaiah has a lot of books at home. Isaiah does beautifully on his reading test at school. This must be because his mother or father regularly reads to him. But Isaiah's friend Emily, who also has a lot of books in her home, practically never touches them. She would rather dress up her brats or watch cartoons. And Emily tests just as well as Isaiah. Meanwhile, Isaiah and Emily's friend Ricky doesn't have any books at home. But Ricky goes to the library every day with his mother. Ricky is a reading fiend. And yet, he does worse on his school tests than either Emily or Isaiah. What are we to make of this? If reading books doesn't have an impact on early childhood test scores, could it be that the book's mere physical presence in the house makes the children smarter? Do books perform some kind of magical osmosis on a child's brain? If so, one might be tempted to simply deliver a truckload of books to every home that contains a preschooler. That, in fact, is what the governor of Illinois tried to do. In early 2004, Governor Rod Blagojevich announced a plan to mail one book a month to every child in Illinois from the time they were born until they entered kindergarten. The plan would cost $26 million a year, but, Blagojevich argued, this was a vital intervention in a state where 40% of third graders read below their grade level. When you own books and they're yours, he said, and they just come as part of your life, all of that will contribute to a sense that books should be a part of your life. So all children born in Illinois would end up with a 60-volume library by the time they entered school. Does this mean they would all perform better on their reading tests? Probably not. Although we may never know for sure, in the end, the Illinois legislature rejected the book plan. After all, the ECLS data doesn't say that books in the house cause high test scores. It says only that the two are correlated. So how should this correlation be interpreted? Here's a likely theory. Most parents who buy a lot of children's books tend to be smart and well-educated to begin with, and they pass on their smarts and work ethic to their kids. Or perhaps they care a great deal about education and about their children in general, which means that they create an environment that encourages and rewards learning. Such parents may believe, as fervently as the governor of Illinois believed, that every children's book is a talisman that leads to unfettered intelligence. But they are probably wrong. A book is in fact less a cause of intelligence than an indicator. So what does all this have to say about the importance of parents in general? Consider again the 8 ECLS factors that are correlated with school test scores, negatively or positively. The child has highly educated parents. The child's parents have high socioeconomic status. The child's mother was 30 or older at the time of her first child's birth. The child had low birth weight. The child's parents speak English in the home. The child is adopted. The child's parents are involved in the PTA. And the child has many books in his home. And now, again, the 8 factors that were not correlated. The child's family is intact. The child's parents recently moved into a better neighborhood. The child's mother didn't work between birth and kindergarten. The child attended Head Start. The child's parents regularly take him to museums. The child is regularly spanked. The child frequently watches television. And the child's parents read to him nearly every day. To overgeneralize a bit, the first list describes things that parents are. The second list describes things that parents do. Parents who are well-educated, successful, and healthy tend to have children who test well in school. But it doesn't seem to much matter whether a child is trotted off to museums or spanked or sent to Head Start or frequently read to or plopped in front of the television. For parents and parenting experts who are obsessed with child-rearing technique, this may be sobering news. The reality is that technique looks to be highly overrated. But this is not to say that parents don't matter. Plainly, they matter a great deal. Here is the conundrum. By the time most people pick up a parenting book, it's far too late. Most of the things that matter were decided long ago. Who you are, whom you married, what kind of life you lead. If you were smart, hard-working, well-educated, well-paid, and married to someone equally fortunate, then your children are more likely to succeed. Nor does it hurt, in all likelihood, to be honest, thoughtful, loving, and curious about the world. But it isn't so much a matter of what you do as a parent, it's who you are. In this regard, an overbearing parent is a lot like a political candidate who believes that money wins elections, whereas, in truth, all the money in the world can't get a candidate elected if the voters don't like him to start with. In a paper titled The Nature and Nurture of Economic Outcomes, the economist Bruce Sacerdote addressed the nature-nurture debate by taking a long-term quantitative look at the effects of parenting. He used three adoption studies, two American and one British, each of them containing in-depth data about the adopted children, their adoptive parents, and their biological parents. Sacerdote found that parents who adopt children are typically smarter, better educated, and more highly paid than the baby's biological parents. But the adoptive parents' advantages had little bearing on the child's school performances. As also seen in the ECLS data, adopted children test relatively poorly in school. Any influence the adoptive parents might exert is seemingly outweighed by the force of genetics. But, Sacerdote found, the parents were not powerless forever. By the time the adopted children became adults, they had veered sharply from the destiny that IQ alone might have predicted. Compared to similar children who were not put up for adoption, the adoptees were far more likely to attend college, to have a well-paid job, and to wait until they were out of their teens before getting married. It was the influence of the adoptive parents, Sacerdote concluded, that made the difference. Chapter 6. Perfect Parenting, Part 2, or Would a Rashonda, by any other name, smell as sweet? Obsessive or not, any parent wants to believe that she is making a big difference in the kind of person her child turns out to be. Otherwise, why bother? The belief in parental power is manifest in the first official act a parent commits, giving the baby a name. As any modern parent knows, the baby naming industry is booming, as evidenced by a proliferation of books, websites, and baby name consultants. Many parents seem to believe that a child cannot prosper unless it is hitched to the right name. Names are seen to carry great aesthetic or even predictive powers. This might explain why, in 1958, a New York City man named Robert Lane decided to call his baby son Winner. The Lanes, who lived in a housing project in Harlem, already had several children, each with a fairly typical name. But this boy, well, Robert Lane apparently had a special feeling about this one. Winner Lane. How could he fail with a name like that? 3 years later, the Lanes had another boy, their seventh and last child. For reasons that no one can quite pin down today, Robert decided to name this boy Loser. It doesn't appear that Robert was unhappy about the new baby. He just seemed to get a kick out of the name's bookend effect. First a winner, now a loser. But if Winner Lane could hardly be expected to fail, could Loser Lane possibly succeed? Loser Lane did, in fact, succeed. He went to prep school on a scholarship, graduated from Lafayette College in Pennsylvania, and joined the New York Police Department. This was his mother's longtime wish, where he made detective and eventually sergeant. Although he never hid his name, many people were uncomfortable using it. "So I have a bunch of names," he says today, "from Jimmy to James to whatever they want to call you, Timmy, but they rarely call you Loser." Once in a while, he said, "they throw a French twist on it, Lusier." To his police colleagues, he is known as Lou. And what of his brother with the can't-miss name? The most noteworthy achievement of Winner Lane, now in his mid-40s, is the sheer length of his criminal record. Nearly 36 arrests for burglary, domestic violence, trespassing, resisting arrest, and other mayhem. These days, Loser and Winner barely speak. The father who named them is no longer alive. Clearly, he had the right idea that naming is destiny, but he must have gotten the boys mixed up. Then there's the recent case of Temptress, a 15-year-old girl whose misdeeds landed her in Albany County Family Court in New York. The judge, W. Dennis Duggan, had long taken note of the strange names borne by some offenders. One teenage boy, Amcher, had been named for the first thing his parents saw upon reaching the hospital, the sign for Albany Medical Center Hospital Emergency Room, Amcher. But Duggan considered Temptress the most outrageous name he had come across. The judge later recalled, "I sent her out of the courtroom so I could talk to her mother about why she named her daughter Temptress. She said she was watching The Cosby Show and liked the young actress. I told her the actress's name was actually Tempest Bledsoe. She said she found that out later, that they misspelled the name. I asked her if she knew what Temptress meant, and she said she also found that out at some later point. Her daughter was charged with ungovernable behavior, which included bringing men into the home while the mother was at work. I asked the mother if she had ever thought the daughter was living out her name. Most all of this went completely over her head." Was Temptress actually living out her name, as Judge Duggan saw it? Or would she have wound up in trouble even if her mother had named her Chastity? It isn't much of a stretch to assume that Temptress didn't have ideal parents. Not only was her mother willing to name her Temptress in the first place, but she wasn't smart enough to know what the word even meant. Nor is it so surprising, on some level, that a boy named Amcher would end up in family court. People who can't be bothered to come up with a name for their child aren't likely to be the best parents either. So, does the name you give your child affect his life, or is it your life reflected in his name? In either case, what kind of signal does a child's name send to the world, and, most important, does it really matter? As it happens, loser and winner, Temptress and Amcher, were all black. Is this fact merely a curiosity, or does it have something larger to say about names and culture? Every generation seems to produce a few marquee academics who advance the thinking on black culture. Roland G. Fryer, Jr., the young black economist who analyzed the acting white phenomenon and the black-white test score gap, may be among the next. His ascension has been unlikely. An indifferent high school student from an unstable family, he went to the University of Texas at Arlington on an athletic scholarship. Two things happened to him there. He quickly realized he would never make the NFL or the NBA, and, taking his studies seriously for the first time in his life, he found he liked them. After graduate work at Penn State and the University of Chicago, he was hired as a Harvard professor at age 25. His reputation for candid thinking on race was already well established. Fryer's mission is the study of black underachievement. One could rattle off all the statistics about blacks not doing so well, he says. You can look at the black-white differential in out-of-wedlock births or infant mortality or life expectancy. Blacks are the worst performing ethnic group on SATs. Blacks are in less than whites. They are still just not doing well, period. I basically want to figure out where blacks went wrong, and I want to devote my life to this. In addition to economic and social disparity between blacks and whites, Fryer has become intrigued by the virtual segregation of culture. Blacks and whites watch different television shows. Monday Night Football is the only show that typically appears on each group's top 10 list. Seinfeld, one of the most popular sitcoms in history, never ranked in the top 50 among blacks. They smoke different cigarettes. Newports enjoy a 75% market share among black teenagers versus 12% among whites. The white teenagers are mainly smoking Marlboros. And black parents give their children names that are starkly different from white children's. Fryer came to wonder, is distinctive black culture a cause of the economic disparity between blacks and whites, or merely a reflection of it? As with the ECLS study, Fryer went looking for the answer in a mountain of data. Birth certificate information for every child born in California since 1961. The data, covering more than 16 million births, included standard items such as name, gender, race, birth weight, and the parent's marital status, as well as more telling factors about the parents. Their zip code, which indicates socioeconomic status and a neighborhood's racial composition. Their means of paying the hospital bill, again, an economic indicator, and their level of education. The California data prove just how dissimilarly black and white parents name their children. White and Asian American parents, meanwhile, give their children remarkably similar names. There is some disparity between white and Hispanic American parents, but it is slim compared to the black-white naming gap. The data also showed the black-white gap to be a recent phenomenon. Until the early 1970s, there was a great overlap between black and white first names. The typical baby girl born in a black neighborhood in 1970 was given a name that was twice as common among blacks than whites. By 1980, she received a name that was 20 times more common among blacks. Boys' names moved in the same direction, but less aggressively, probably because parents of all races are less adventurous with boys' names than girls. Given the location and timing of this change, dense urban areas where Afro-American activism was gaining strength, the most likely cause of the explosion in distinctively black names was the Black Power movement, which sought to accentuate African culture and fight claims of black inferiority. If this naming revolution was indeed inspired by black power, it would be one of the movement's most enduring remnants. Afros today are rare, dashikis even rarer. Black Panther founder Bobby Seale is best known today for peddling a line of barbecue products. A great many black names today are unique to blacks. More than 40% of the black girls born in California in a given year receive a name that not one of the roughly 100,000 baby white girls received that year. Even more remarkably, nearly 30% of the black girls are given a name that is unique among every baby, white and black, born that year in California. There were also 228 babies named unique during the 1990s alone. Even among very popular black names, there's little overlap with whites. Of the 626 baby girls named Deja in the 1990s, 591 were black. Of the 454 girls named Precious, 431 were black. Of the 318 Shanices, 310 were black. What kind of parent is most likely to give a child such a distinctively black name? The data offer a clear answer. An unmarried, low-income, undereducated teenage mother from a black neighborhood who has a distinctively black name herself. In Roland Fryer's view, giving a child a super black name is a black parent's signal of solidarity with the community. If I start naming my kid Madison, he says, you might think, oh, you want to go live across the railroad tracks, don't you? If black kids who study calculus and ballet are thought to be acting white, Fryer says, then mothers who call their babies Shanice are simply acting black. The California study shows that many white parents send as strong a signal in the opposite direction. More than 40% of the white babies are given names that are at least four times more common among whites. Consider Connor and Cody, Emily and Abigail. In one recent 10-year stretch, each of these names was given to at least 2,000 babies in California, fewer than 2% of them black. So, what are the whitest names and the blackest names? Here are the 20 whitest girl names. Molly, Amy, Claire, Emily, Katie, Madeline, Caitlin, Emma, Abigail, Carly, Jenna, Heather, Catherine, Caitlin, another spelling, Caitlin, a third spelling, Holly, Allison, fourth Caitlin, Hannah, and another spelling of Catherine. Now, the 20 blackest girl names. Imani, Ebony, Shanice, Aaliyah, Precious, Nia, Deja, Diamond, Asia, another Aaliyah, Jada, Tierra, Tiara, Kiara, Jasmine, another Jasmine, a third spelling of Jasmine, a fourth spelling of Jasmine, Alexis, and Raven. Now, the 20 whitest boy names. Jake, Connor, Tanner, Wyatt, Cody, Dustin, Luke, Jack, Scott, Logan, Cole, Lucas, Bradley, Jacob, Garrett, Dylan, Maxwell, Hunter, Brett, and Colin. And now, the 20 blackest boy names. Deshaun, DeAndre, Marcus, Darnell, Terrell, Malik, Trevin, Tyrone, Willie, Dominique, Demetrius, Reginald, Jamal, Maurice, Jalen, Darius, Xavier, Terrence, Andre, and Daryl. So, how does it matter if you have a very white name or a very black name? Over the years, a series of audit studies have tried to measure how people perceive different names. In a typical audit study, a researcher would send two identical and fake resumes, one with a traditionally white name and the other with an immigrant or minority-sounding name, to potential employers. The white resumes have always gleaned more job interviews. According to such a study, if Deshaun Williams and Jake Williams sent identical resumes to the same employer, Jake Williams would be more likely to get a callback. The implication is that black-sounding names carry an economic penalty. Such studies are tantalizing, but severely limited, for they can't explain why Deshaun didn't get the call. Was he rejected because the employer is a racist and he's convinced that Deshaun Williams is black? Or did he reject him because Deshaun sounds like someone from a low-income, low-education family? A resume is a fairly undependable set of clues. A recent study showed that more than 50% of them contained lies. So Deshaun may simply signal a disadvantaged background to an employer who believes that workers from such backgrounds are undependable. Nor do the black-white audit studies predict what might have happened in a job interview. What if the employer is racist, and if he unwittingly agreed to interview a black person who happened to have a white-sounding name, would he be any more likely to hire the black applicant after meeting face-to-face? Or is the interview a painful and discouraging waste of time for the black applicant, that is, an economic penalty for having a white-sounding name? Along those same lines, perhaps a black person with a white name pays an economic penalty in the black community. And what of the potential advantage to be gained in the black community by having a distinctively black name? But because the audit studies can't measure the actual life outcomes of the fictitious Deshaun Williams versus Jake Williams, they can't assess the broader impact of a distinctively black name. Maybe Deshaun should just change his name. People do this all the time, of course. The clerks in New York City's civil court recently reported that name changes are at an all-time high. Some of the changes are purely, if bizarrely, aesthetic. A young couple named Natalie Jeremijenko and Dalton Conley recently renamed their 4-year-old son Yo Zing Haino Augustus Eisner Alexander Weiser Knuckles Jeremijenko Conley. Some people change names for economic purposes. After a New York livery cab driver named Michael Goldberg was shot in early 2004, it was reported that Mr. Goldberg was, in fact, an Indian-born Sikh who thought it advantageous to take a Jewish name upon immigrating to New York. Goldberg's decision might have puzzled some people in show business circles, where it is a time-honored tradition to change Jewish names. Thus did Isor Danielovich become Kirk Douglas. Thus did the William Morris Agency rise to prominence under its namesake, the former Zelman Moses. The question is, would Zelman Moses have done as well had he not become William Morris? And would Deshaun Williams do any better if he called himself Jake Williams or Connor Williams? It's tempting to think so, just as it is tempting to think that a truckload of children's books will make a child smarter. Though the audit studies can't be used to truly measure how much a name matters, the California names data can. How? The California data included not only each baby's vital statistics, but information about the mother's level of education, income, and most significantly, her own date of birth. This last fact made it possible to identify the hundreds of thousands of California mothers who had themselves been born in California, and then to link them to their own birth records. Now, a new and extremely potent story emerged from the data. It was possible to track the life outcome of any individual woman. This is the sort of data chain that researchers dream about, making it possible to identify a set of children who were born under similar circumstances, then locate them again 20 or 30 years later to see how they turned out. Among the hundreds of thousands of such women in the California data, many bore distinctively black names, and many others did not. Using regression analysis to control for other factors that might influence life trajectories, it was then possible to measure the impact of a single factor, in this case, a woman's first name, on her educational, income, and health outcomes. So, does a name matter? The data show that, on average, a person with a distinctively black name, whether it's a woman named Imani or a man named Deshaun, does have a worse life outcome than a woman named Molly or a man named Jake. But it isn't the fault of their names. If two black boys, Jake Williams and Deshaun Williams, are born in the same neighborhood and into the same familial and economic circumstances, they would likely have similar life outcomes. But the kind of parents who name their son Jake don't tend to live in the same neighborhoods or share economic circumstances with the kind of parents who name their son Deshaun. And that's why, on average, a boy named Jake will tend to earn more money and get more education than a boy named Deshaun. A Deshaun is more likely to have been handicapped by a low-income, low-education, single-parent background. His name is an indicator, not a cause, of his outcome. Just as a child with no books in his home isn't likely to test well in school, a boy named Deshaun isn't likely to do as well in life. And what if Deshaun had changed his name to Jake or Connor? Would his situation improve? Here's a guess. Anybody who bothers to change his name in the name of economic success is, like the high school freshman in Chicago who entered the school choice lottery, at least highly motivated. And motivation is probably a stronger indicator of success than, well, a name. Just as the ECLS data answered questions about parenting that went well beyond the black-white test gap, the California names data tell a lot of stories in addition to the one about distinctively black names. Broadly speaking, the data tell us how parents see themselves, and more significantly, what kind of expectations they have for their children. Here's a question to begin with. Where does a name come from anyway? Not that is the actual source of the name, that much is usually obvious. There's the Bible, there's the huge cluster of traditional English and Germanic and Italian and French names. There are princess names and hippie names, nostalgic names and place names. Increasingly, there are brand names, Lexus, Armani, Bacardi, Timberland, and what might be called aspirational names. The California data show 8 Harvards born during the 1990s, all of them black. 15 Yales, all white, and 18 Princetons, all black. There were no doctors, but 3 lawyers, all black, 9 judges, 8 of them white, 3 senators, all white, and 2 presidents, both black. Then there are the invented names. Roland G. Fryer Jr., while discussing his name's research on a radio show, took a call from a black woman who was upset with the name just given to her baby niece. It was pronounced Shateed, but was in fact spelled Shithead. Or consider the twin boys, Orange Jello and Lemon Jello, also black, whose parents further dignify their choice by instituting this pronunciation, Arangelo and Lamangelo. Arangelo, Lamangelo, and Shateed have yet to catch on among the masses, but other names do. How does a name migrate through the population, and why? Is it purely a matter of zeitgeist, or is there a more sensible explanation? We all know that names rise and fall and rise, witness the return of Sophie and Max from near extinction, but is there a discernible pattern to these movements? The answer lies in the California data, and the answer is yes. Among the most interesting revelations in the data is the correlation between a baby's name and the parent's socioeconomic status. Consider the most common female names found in middle-income white households versus low-income white households. These and other lists to follow include data from the 1990s alone to ensure a large sample that is also current. So here are the most common middle-income white girl names. Sarah, Emily, Jessica, Lauren, Ashley, Amanda, Megan, Samantha, Hannah, Rachel, Nicole, Taylor, Elizabeth, Catherine, Madison, Jennifer, Alexandra, Brittany, Danielle, and Rebecca. And now, the most common low-income white girl names. Ashley, Jessica, Amanda, Samantha, Brittany, Sarah, Kayla, Amber, Megan, Taylor, Emily, Nicole, Elizabeth, Heather, Alyssa, Stephanie, Jennifer, Hannah, Courtney, and Rebecca. There is considerable overlap between the two lists, to be sure, but keep in mind that these are the most common names of all, and consider the size of the data set. The difference between consecutive positions on these lists may represent several hundred or even several thousand children. So if Brittany is number 5 on the low-income list and number 18 on the middle-income list, you can be assured that Brittany is a decidedly low-end name. Other examples are even more pronounced. 5 names in each category don't appear at all in the other category's top 20. Here now are the top 5 names among high-end and low-end families in order of their relative disparity with the other category. So, the 5 most common high-end white girl names: Alexandra, Lauren, Catherine, Madison, and Rachel. And the 5 common low-end white girl names: Amber, Heather, Kayla, Stephanie, and Alyssa. And now for the boys, the most common high-end white boy names: Benjamin, Samuel, Jonathan, Alexander, Andrew. And the most common low-end white boy names: Cody, Brandon, Anthony, Justin, and Robert. Considering the relationship between income and names, and given the fact that income and education are strongly correlated, it isn't surprising to find a similarly strong link between the parents' level of education and the name they give their baby. Once again, drawing from the pool of most common names among white children, here are the top picks of highly educated parents versus those with the least education. So, the most common white girl names among high education parents: Catherine, Emma, Alexandra, Julia, and Rachel. And the most common white girl names among low education parents: Kayla, Amber, Heather, Brittany, and Brianna. Now, the most common white boy names among high education parents: Benjamin, Samuel, Alexander, John, and William. And the most common white boy names among low education parents: Cody, Travis, Brandon, Justin, and Tyler. This effect is even more pronounced when the sample is widened beyond the most common names. Now, drawing from the entire California database, here are the names that signify the most poorly educated white parents. Now, here are the 20 white girl names that best signify low education parents. If you hear a name twice, that means there's more than one spelling: Angel, Heaven, Misty, Destiny, Brenda, Tabitha, spelled T-A-B-A-T-H-A, Bobby, Brandy, Destiny, Cindy, Jasmine, Cheyenne, Brittany with one T, Mercedes, Tiffany, ending in I-E, Ashley, ending L-Y, Tanya, Crystal, Brandy, and Brandy. If you or someone you love is named Cindy or Brenda and is over, say, 40, and feels that those names did not formally connote a low-education family, you're right. These names, like many others, have shifted hard and fast of late. Some of the other low-education names are obvious misspellings, whether intentional or not, of more standard names. In most cases, the standard spellings of the names, Tabitha or Cheyenne, Tiffany, Brittany, or Jasmine, also signify low education. Now, here's a list of low-education white boy names. It includes the occasional misspelling, Michael spelled M-I-C-H-E-A-L, and Tyler spelled T-Y-L-O-R, but more common is the nickname as proper name trend. So now, the 20 white boy names that best signify low-education parents: Ricky, Joey, Jesse, Jimmy, Billy, Bobby, Johnny, Larry, Edgar, Steve, Tommy, Tony, misspelled Michael, Ronnie, Randy, Jerry, misspelled Tyler, Terry, Danny, and Harley. Now for the names that signify the highest level of parental education. These names don't have much in common, phonetically or aesthetically, with the low education names. The girls' names are in most regards diverse, though with a fair share of literary and otherwise artful touches. A caution to prospective parents who are shopping for a so-called smart name, remember that such a name won't make your child smart. It will, however, give her the same name as some other smart kids, at least for a little while. So now, the 20 white girl names that best signify high education parents. Lucienne, Marie Claire, Glynis, Adair, Mayura, Beatrix, Clementine, Philippa, Aviva, Flannery, Rotem, Una, Atara, Lyndon, Waverly, Zofia, Pascal, Eleonora, Elika, and Nika. Now for the boys' names that are turning up these days in high education households. This list is particularly heavy on the Hebrew, with a noticeable trend toward Irish traditionalism. Now, the 20 white boy names that best signify high education parents. Dove, Akiva, Sander, Yannick, Sasha, Guillaume, Elon, Ansel, Yona, Tor, Finnegan, McGregor, Florian, Zev, Beckett, Kia, Ashkan, Harper, Sumner, and Calder. If many names on these lists were unfamiliar to you, don't feel bad. Even boys' names, which have always been scarcer than girls, have been proliferating wildly. This means that even the most popular names today are less popular than they used to be. Consider the 10 most popular names given to black baby boys in California in 1990 and then in 2000. The top 10 in 1990 includes 3,375 babies, or more than 18% of those born that year, while the top 10 in 2000 includes only 2,115 babies, or more than 14% of those born that year. So, here are the most popular black baby boy names, first in 1990. Michael, Christopher, Anthony, Brandon, James, Joshua, Robert, David, Kevin, and Justin. And now, the most popular names among black baby boys in the year 2000. Isaiah, Jordan, Elijah, Michael, Joshua, Anthony, Christopher, Jalen, Brandon, and Justin. The most popular name in 1990, Michael, was received by 532 babies that year. The most popular name in 2000, Isaiah, was received by only 308 babies. So, in the space of 10 years, even the single most popular name among black baby boys became far less popular. So, parents are plainly getting more diverse with names. But there's another noteworthy shift in these lists, a very quick rate of turnover. Note that four of the 1990 names, James, Robert, David, and Kevin, fell out of the top 10 by 2000. Now, granted, they made up the bottom half of the 1990 list, but the names that replaced them in 2000 were not bottom dwellers. Three of the new names, Isaiah, Jordan, and Elijah, were in fact numbers 1, 2, and 3 in the year 2000. For an even more drastic example of how quickly and thoroughly a name can cycle in and out of use, consider the 10 most popular names given to white girls in California in 1960 and then in the year 2000. All right, the most popular white girl names in 1960. Susan, Lisa, Karen, Mary, Cynthia, Deborah, Linda, Patricia, Deborah, and Sandra. Now, the most popular white girl names in 2000. Emily, Hannah, Madison, Sarah, Samantha, Lauren, Ashley, Emma, Taylor, and Megan. Not a single name from 1960 remains in the top 10. But you say it's hard to stay popular for 40 years. So how about comparing today's most popular names with the top 10 from only 20 years earlier? Now, the most popular white girl names from 1980. Jennifer, Sarah, Melissa, Jessica, Christina, Amanda, Nicole, Michelle, Heather, and Amber. And, again, the most popular white girl names in 2000. Emily, Hannah, Madison, Sarah, Samantha, Lauren, Ashley, Emma, Taylor, and Megan. A single holdover from the 1980 list to the 2000 list. Sarah. So where do these Emilys and Emmas and Laurens all come from? Where on earth did Madison come from? It's easy enough to see that new names become very popular very fast, but why? Let's take another look at a pair of earlier lists. Here are the most popular names given to white baby girls in the 1990s among low-income families and among families of middle income or higher. The most common high-end white girl names of the 1990s were Alexandra, Lauren, Catherine, Madison, and Rachel. And the most common low-end white girl names of the 1990s were Amber, Heather, Kayla, Stephanie, and Alyssa. Notice anything? You might want to compare these names with the most popular white girl names list I read earlier, which includes the top 10 overall names from 1980 and 2000. Lauren and Madison, two of the most popular high-end names from the 1990s, made the 2000 top 10 overall list. Amber and Heather, meanwhile, which were two of the overall most popular names from 1980, are now among the low-end names. There is a clear pattern at play. Once a name catches on among high-income, highly educated parents, it starts working its way down the socioeconomic ladder. Amber and Heather started out as high-end names, as did Stephanie and Brittany. For every high-end baby named Stephanie or Brittany, another five lower-income girls received those names within 10 years. So where do lower-end families go name shopping? Many people assume that naming trends are driven by celebrities, but celebrities actually have a weak effect on baby names. As of the year 2000, the pop star Madonna had sold 130 million records worldwide, but hadn't generated even the 10 copycat namings, in California no less, required to make the master index of 4,000 names from which these various lists of girls' names have been drawn. Or, considering all the Britneys you encounter these days, you might think of Britney Spears, but she is in fact a symptom, not a cause, of the Britney explosion. With the most common spelling of the name, B-R-I-T-T-A-N-Y, at number 18 among high-end families, and number 5 among low-end families, it is surely approaching its pull date. Decades earlier, Shirley Temple was similarly a symptom of the Shirley boom, though she is often now remembered as its cause. It should also be noted that many girls' names, including Shirley, Carol, Leslie, Hillary, Renee, Stacy, and Tracy, began life as boys' names, but girls' names almost never cross over to boys. So it isn't famous people who drive the name game. It's the family just a few blocks over, the one with the bigger house and newer car. The kind of families that were the first to call their daughters Amber or Heather and are now calling them Lauren or Madison. The kind of families that used to name their sons Justin or Brandon and are now calling them Alexander or Benjamin. Parents are reluctant to poach a name from someone too near, family members or close friends, but many parents, whether they realize it or not, like the sound of names that sound successful. But as a high-end name is adopted en masse, high-end parents begin to abandon it. Eventually, it's considered so common that even lower-end parents may not want it, whereby it falls out of the rotation entirely. The lower-end parents, meanwhile, go looking for the next name that the upper-end parents have broken in. So, the implication is clear. The parents of all those Alexandras, Laurens, Catherines, Madisons, and Rachels should not expect the cachet to last much longer. Those names are already on their way to overexposure. Where then will the new high-end names come from? It wouldn't be surprising to find them among the so-called smartest girls' and boys' names in California cited earlier that are still fairly obscure. Granted, some of them, Una and Glynis, Florian and Kia, are bound to remain obscure. The same could be surmised of most of the Hebrew names, Rotem and Zophia, Akiva and Zev, even though many of today's most mainstream names, David, Jonathan, Samuel, Benjamin, Rachel, Hannah, Sarah, and Rebecca are, of course, Hebrew biblical names. Aviva may be the one modern Hebrew name that's ready to break out. It's easy to pronounce, pretty, peppy, and suitably flexible. Drawn from a pair of so-called smart databases, here now is a sampling of today's high-end names. Some of them, as unlikely as it seems, are bound to become tomorrow's mainstream names. Before you scoff, ask yourself this. Do any of them seem more ridiculous than Madison might have seemed 10 years ago? Now, the potential most popular girls' names of the year 2015. Annika, Ansley, Ava, Avery, Aviva, Clementine, Eleanor, Ella, Emma, Fiona, Flannery, Grace, Isabel, Kate, Lara, Lyndon, Maeve, Marie Claire, Maya, Philippa, Phoebe, Quinn, Sophie, and Waverly. And the potential most popular boys' names of the year 2015. Aiden, Aldo, Anderson, Ansel, Asher, Beckett, Bennett, Carter, Cooper, Finnegan, Harper, Jackson, Johan, Keon, Liam, Maximilian, McGregor, Oliver, Reagan, Sander, Sumner, and Will. Obviously, a variety of motives are at work when parents consider a name for their child. They may want something traditional or something bohemian, something unique or something perfectly trendy. It would be an overstatement to suggest that all parents are looking, whether consciously or not, for a so-called smart name or a so-called high-end name, but they are all trying to signal something with a name, whether the name is winner or loser, Madison or Amber, Shatid or Sander, Deshaun or Jake. What the California Names data suggest is that an overwhelming number of parents use a name to signal their own expectations of how successful their children will be. The name isn't likely to make a shard of difference. But the parents can at least feel better knowing that from the very outset, they tried their best. Epilogue. Two paths to Harvard. And now, with all these pages behind us, an early promise has been confirmed. This book indeed has no unifying theme. But if there is no unifying theme to the book Freakonomics, there is at least a common thread running through the everyday application of Freakonomics. It has to do with thinking sensibly about how people behave in the real world. All it requires is a novel way of looking, of discerning, of measuring. This isn't necessarily a difficult task, nor does it require super sophisticated thinking. We have essentially tried to figure out what the typical gang member or sumo wrestler figured out on his own, although we had to do so in reverse. Will the ability to think such thoughts improve your life materially? Probably not. Perhaps you'll put up a sturdy gate around your swimming pool or push your real estate agent to work a little harder. But the net effect is likely to be more subtle than that. You might become more skeptical of the conventional wisdom. You may begin looking for hints as to how things aren't quite what they seem. Perhaps you'll even seek out some trove of data and sift through it, balancing your intelligence and your intuition to arrive at a glimmering new idea. Some of these ideas might make you uncomfortable, even unpopular. To claim that legalized abortion resulted in a massive drop in crime will inevitably lead to explosive moral reactions. But the fact of the matter is that Freakonomics-style thinking simply doesn't traffic in morality. As we suggested near the beginning of this recording, if morality represents an ideal world, then economics represents the actual world. The most likely result of having heard this recording is a simple one. You may find yourself asking a lot of questions. Many of them will lead to nothing, but some will produce answers that are interesting, even surprising. Consider the question posed a couple of chapters ago. How much do parents really matter? The data have by now made it clear that parents matter a great deal in some regards, most of which have been long determined by the time a child is born, and not at all in others. Those are the ones we obsess about. You can't blame parents for trying to do something, anything, to help their child succeed, even if it's something as irrelevant as giving him a high-end first name. But there is also a huge random effect that rains down on even the best parenting efforts. If you are in any way typical, you have known some intelligent and devoted parents whose child went badly off the rails. You may have also known of the opposite instance, where a child succeeds despite his parents' worst intentions and habits. Recall for a moment the two boys, one black and one white, described a couple chapters ago. The white boy, who grew up outside Chicago, had smart, solid, encouraging, loving parents who stressed education and family. The black boy from Daytona Beach was abandoned by his mother, was beaten by his father, and had become a full-fledged gangster by his teens. So what became of the two boys? The second child, now 27 years old, is Roland G. Fryer Jr., the Harvard economist studying black underachievement. The white child also made it to Harvard, but soon after, things went badly for him. His name is Ted Kaczynski. Here now is some bonus material in the revised expanded edition of Freakonomics. The probability that a real estate agent is cheating you and other riddles of modern life. Inside the Curious Mind of the Heralded Young Economist Stephen Levitt. By Stephen J. Dubner. From the New York Times Magazine, August 3, 2003. The most brilliant young economist in America, the one so deemed at least by a jury of his elders, breaks to a stop at a traffic light on Chicago's south side. It is a sunny day in mid-June. He drives an aging green Chevy Cavalier with a dusty dashboard and a window that doesn't quite shut, producing a dull roar at highway speeds. But the car is quiet for now, as are the noontime streets. Gas stations, boundless concrete, brick buildings with plywood windows. An elderly homeless man approaches. It says he is homeless right on his sign, which also asks for money. He wears a torn jacket, too heavy for the warm day, and a grimy red baseball cap. The economist doesn't lock his doors or inch the car forward, nor does he go scrounging for spare change. He just watches, as if through one-way glass. After a while, the homeless man moves along. "He had nice headphones," says the economist, still watching in the rearview mirror. "Well, nicer than the ones I have. Otherwise, it doesn't look like he has many assets." Stephen Levitt tends to see things differently than the average person. Differently, too, than the average economist. This is either a wonderful trait or a troubling one, depending on how you feel about economists. The average economist is known to wax oracularly about any and all monetary issues. But if you were to ask Levitt his opinion of some standard economic matter, he would probably swipe the hair from his eyes and plead ignorance. "I gave up a long time ago pretending that I knew stuff I didn't know," he says. I just don't know very much about the field of economics. I'm not good at math. I don't know a lot of econometrics. I also don't know how to do theory. If you ask me about whether the stock market's going to go up or down, if you ask me whether the economy's going to grow or shrink, if you ask me whether deflation's good or bad, if you ask me about taxes, I mean, it would be total fakery if I said I knew anything about any of those things. In Levitt's view, economics is a science with excellent tools for gaining answers, but a serious shortage of interesting questions. His particular gift is the ability to ask such questions. For instance, if drug dealers make so much money, why do they still live with their mothers? Which is more dangerous, a gun or a swimming pool? What really caused crime rates to plunge during the past decade? Do real estate agents have their clients' best interests at heart? Why do black parents give their children names that may hurt their career prospects? Do school teachers cheat to meet high-stakes testing standards? Is sumo wrestling corrupt? And how does a homeless man afford $50 headphones? Many people, including a fair number of his peers, might not recognize Levitt's work as economics at all. But he has merely distilled the so-called dismal science down to its most primal aim, explaining how people get what they want or need. Unlike most academics, he is unafraid of using personal observations and curiosities, though he is afraid of calculus. He is an intuitionist. He sifts through a pile of data to find a story that no one else had found. He devises a way to measure an effect that veteran economists had declared unmeasurable. His abiding interests, though he says he has never trafficked in them himself, are cheating, corruption, and crime. His interest in the homeless man's headphones, meanwhile, didn't last long. Maybe, he said later, it was just testimony to the fact that I'm too disorganized to buy a set of headphones that I myself covet. Levitt is the first to say that some of his topics border on the trivial, but he has proved to be such an ingenious researcher and clear-eyed thinker that instead of being consigned to the fringe of the field, the opposite has happened. He has shown other economists just how well their tools can make sense of the real world. Levitt is considered a demigod, one of the most creative people in economics and maybe in all social science, says Colin Kammerer, an economist at the California Institute of Technology. He represents something that everyone thinks they will be when they go to grad school in econ, but usually they have the creative spark bored out of them by endless math, namely a kind of intellectual detective trying to figure stuff out. Levitt is a populist in a field that is undergoing a bout of popularization. Undergraduates are swarming the economics departments of elite universities. Economics is seen as the ideal blend of intellectual prestige, it does offer Nobel after all, and practical training for a high-flying finance career, unless, like Levitt, you choose to stay in academia. At the same time, economics is ever more visible in the real world, thanks to the continuing fetishization of the stock market and the continuing fixation with Alan Greenspan. The greatest change, however, is within the scholarly ranks. Microeconomists are gaining on the macro crowd, empiricists gaining on the theorists. Behavioral economists have called into doubt the very notion of homo economicus, the supposedly rational decision maker in each of us. Young economists of every stripe are more inclined to work on real-world subjects and dip into bordering disciplines, psychology, criminology, sociology, even neurology, with the intent of rescuing their science from its slavish dependence upon mathematical models. Levitt fits everywhere and nowhere. He is a noetic butterfly that no one has pinned down. He was once offered a job on the Clinton economic team, and the Bush campaign approached him about being a crime advisor. But he's widely appreciated. Steve isn't really a behavioral economist, but they'd be happy to have him, says Austin Goolsbee, who teaches economics at the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business. He's not really an old price theory guy, but these Chicago guys are happy to claim him too. He's not really a Cambridge guy, although Levitt went to Harvard and then MIT, but they'd love to have him come back. He has critics, to be sure. Daniel Hammermesh, a prominent labor economist at the University of Texas, has taught Levitt's paper, The Impact of Legalized Abortion on Crime, to his undergraduates. I've gone over this paper in draft, in its printed version at great length, and for the life of me, I can't see anything wrong with it, Hammermesh says. On the other hand, I don't believe a word of it. And his stuff on sumo wrestlers, well, this is not exactly fundamental, unless you're Japanese and weigh 500 pounds. But at 36, Levitt is a full professor in the University of Chicago's economics department, the most legendary program in the country. He received tenure after only 2 years. He is an editor of the Journal of Political Economy, a leading journal in the field, and the American Economic Association recently awarded Levitt its John Bates Clark Medal, given biennially to the country's best economist under 40. He is a prolific and diverse writer, but his paper linking a rise in abortion to a drop in crime has made more noise than the rest combined. Levitt and his co-author, John Donahue of Stanford Law School, argued that as much as 50% of the huge drop in crime since the early 1990s can be traced to Roe v. Wade. Their thinking goes like this. The women most likely to seek an abortion, poor, single, black, or teenage mothers, were the very women whose children, if born, have been shown most likely to become criminals. But since those children weren't born, crime began to decrease during the years they would have entered their criminal prime. In conversation, Levitt reduces this theory to a tidy syllogism. Unwantedness leads to high crime. Abortion leads to less unwantedness. Abortion leads to less crime. Levitt had already published